Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, welcome back. On the face of it, our next guest, Amanda Grace, had it all. Two loving parents, an idyllic childhood, trips to Disneyland in the 80s, that sounds great, and even a helicopter parked outside the front door at one point. Her late father, of course, Brendan Grace, one of the country's most beloved, successful, most adored, brilliant comedians. But for his eldest child, Amanda, life wasn't at all perfect, and her troubles began, maybe we'll find out, when the family left Dublin for Florida. It was around the mid-90s. But she has thankfully survived all the woes and works these days as an inner work mentor, public speaker and podcaster, and all-round person, I believe, full of crack. Good morning, Amanda Grace.
Good morning. Welcome. How are you?
You've lived all around the place, I was reading. Where's home nowadays? Where are you?
I live now in Ballina in Tipperary.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Is that one of those complicated places on the across the water and it's...
Yeah, on one side it's Tip, on the other side it's Clare, and I've lived on both sides.
Oh, yes.
So don't ask me to choose between them. They're both lovely. They all have lovely bums.
There's more than just one border area than bottoms. So that is home. That's and the rest of your family, are they? They're
they all
still
live
in America.
In America, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So when the whole family, which we'll get into it. And yeah. Who's in your life now? You're married to Terry?
Terry is my husband.
Lovely husband.
And we live in Ballina. And we had a 16-year-old golden doodle up until last year, Ted.
I know.
Yeah. And my dad used to call him his granddog.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So that's, it's just me and the cat and Terry now.
That's one of the needy dogs, is the poodle. Or was it
a golden doodle.
A golden doodle.
Yes. Right. Yeah. A little bit needy, all right, yeah.
But sad to lose your pet.
Ah, yeah, my buddy. But we'd a great life together.
And Terry's a Leitrim man.
He is.
So Dublin and Leitrim get along.
That's it. Yeah, Dustin was wrong, as it turns out.
So you have a nice existence there on the beautiful waters.
Do you know, I really do, Oliver. It's just such a fabulous place. I have a fantastic community. I'm sure my neighbours are listening as well. And you know, because I texted lots of people and threatened them that if they didn't listen, I'd haunt them. But yeah, I'm really, really happy down there. It is home for me. It's the place I've lived in the longest.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
You would have grown up in Dublin. Where in Dublin did you?
So it would have started like as an infant in town. And then we moved out to Temple Oak, and I was there until I was about five. And yeah. Then we moved up to Saggart. And then from Saggart, the emigration in 94 when I was 18.
18?
Yeah.
Right. Did you want to move to Florida when you were 18?
No, I didn't.
And this is like early 90s. It seems like Florida is the golden hope of everything. Everybody would have.
Well, that's what probably everyone would have thought. But of course, I had just turned 18, you know, and I was like finally of legal drinking age. Not that that ever stopped me before that. But but I was, you know, and I was kind of like I don't know if you'd say a boyfriend, but I had somebody, and I just didn't want to go. I was just having fun, and I was kind of like just doing my thing.
Your whole life would have been here.
Yeah, so I kind of went with a bit of resistance, and I did not make life easy for anybody once I got there, because I went under duress. I was literally put on the plane, like physically put on the plane.
And you're the eldest of the family.
I'm the eldest. Well,
kids.
I'm the eldest of four. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but your existence in Dublin was stunning. It was a great life.
Oh my God, we had the best life. And I've been thinking about it over the last few days, you know, since talking to Caroline and asking me,
Caroline,
you know,
what is our producer, yeah.
Yeah, and what was life growing up like? And it was exciting. Like being in the studios here is just such a nostalgic, it's such a special thing for me. And it's my first time ever to be in the radio studios without my dad. You know,
you would have come in when he was doing interviews and so on.
Oh, yeah, I always tagged along. You know, even as a kid, I'd go to the studios to record his songs, and I'd be sitting with my colouring book and my packed lunch, and he'd be in the studio recording with, you know, Eamon Campbell and all the boys. And I just remember the smells of studio and cigarettes and guitar cases and strings and...
Did you ever go on air with him as a kid, or did you sing with him?
We were on Anything Goes as kids, remember, with Angus McAnally?
Yeah, yeah.
And we would have been, I was on Miriam O'Callaghan with him. We were on The Late Late Show. I was on Bebe Baskin when I was 10.
Remember that.
And she spoke to me as Gaeilge on the telly, and I was mortal. I was.
Well, she's beautiful Irish. So
oh yeah, and I believe you were in the Gaeltacht there the other day.
We were, yeah, just yesterday. Yeah, mm-hmm. Great time. So it was a real life of showbiz as a kid coming in, and the back of theatres, of course, because he toured endlessly and performed endlessly.
I know. Yeah, and that's another place. Like I was in the Nina Arts Centre the other day, walking around, and Trish was showing me around and backstage, and just. The sound of walking on a stage and the curtains back there and all the wires and bits and pieces. It's just so home to me.
He sounds, both your parents, because Eileen, she's still alive, your mum.
Oh, she is indeed, yeah.
Were really effervescent, really loved people and loved being around people and chatters. And
yeah, we're very social people. We absolutely are, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a fun showbiz lifestyle. There wasn't. Did you see stress along the way because he worked so hard?
Yeah, there was definitely stress. And you know, there was always, my dad was always in an argument with the clock. He was always up against time, you know. And but there was, you know, and he worked very hard, you know, and he played hard too. So like there was always a lot going on. But my mom brought the balance to the house, you know. So whatever chaos was going on in, I mean, self-employment is chaos anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, putting yourself out there and like the labour and the burden of, even though he loved it, to perform and entertain people, it has a cost, you know. But my mum brought all of the grounding to our family.
Did she?
So it was a lovely balance we had.
Did she manage to rein in partying? Because he was a big star of the 80s and like everybody who became famous at whatever level Ireland was, what it was like in those days, it was a party time, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Dad could party with the best of them. But yeah, she'd absolutely put her foot down in the beginning, you know, with young kids in the house, you know, because my dad would be likely to bring people home, you know.
Is that right? Okay.
Oh yeah, she said one time he brought an entire family back to the house and they stayed for 2 weeks and she was like, no, there'd be no more of that.
Because he just loved people that much.
Yeah.
He was extraordinarily successful. What was your lifestyle like growing up in the 80s?
We had a great life. We had great holidays. We had the best of everything. We would eat out and just anything that you wanted, you know. We never wanted for anything, put it that way. You know, we had a beautiful house. And we had a lot of fun, you know. There was always cars and motorbikes. And at one point there was a double-decker bus parked in the... I used to go up there and smoke. You know, me and my friends used to smoke.
The double-decker bus?
Down the back of the out by the garage.
Why was there a bus? What was that about?
Did you know my dad?
I
don't have enough time.
It was just
a
vagary happened one day.
Do you know what? He was a big kid. He was just a big kid. Okay. And just anything, like he was quite impulsive as well. And just, you know, if he got an idea, that was it, you know.
It just had to happen.
Yeah.
Was there really a helicopter there at one stage?
There was.
And it was used?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. He wouldn't be flying to the shops in it or whatever, you know, but he'd be going to the races or here and there. But yeah, he bought himself a helicopter at one point.
And there was always nice cars, I presume. And you went to Disneyland, which would be unusual in the 80s, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I read your interview, brilliant interview with Eddie Rowley in the Sunday World.
Eddie is great.
And so great. If money could buy you happiness, it would have been mine.
Yeah.
But of course it doesn't, was the thing you said.
Yeah.
And does your difficulties kind of begin? Do they begin when that move happens to Florida? Because a big uprooting for you.
Well, I guess when we moved to Florida, what started to surface there was the coping that was at play. But before that and all along, there was an insecurity. And there was a, you know, a sense of inadequacy. And I realise now there was just a shame that I had. A lot of it was about, you know, having what I had in life, you know, and in the 80s. And it was, you know, it was quite a contrast to a lot of people around me. And so there was a little bit of that. But then there was always, there was also this kind of like just insecurity in me that I spent most of my life outsourcing the answers to the kind of questions that would keep me up at night, you know, like, who am I? What am I doing? Am I doing enough? Are you mad at me? You know, all those questions and a lot of anxiety as a result. And of course, isolation and depression, because I didn't even know it was happening. I just thought it was real, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to cope with that in a kind of a bravado way, you know, so I kind of became quite rebellious And I made it my mission in life. You know, it was almost like a badge. I went around pretending I didn't care, pretending I was, you know, invulnerable, all these things. And of course, carrying on like that got me into a lot of trouble, you know.
It's surprising, particularly because home was very stable. And
yeah.
It was a lovely family existence and yeah. There was security at home.
Yes.
So so you couldn't really... there was no excuse to kind of say, oh, I know what... You couldn't know what was wrong, essentially, could you?
No, I didn't. You know, exactly. I didn't come from anything wrong. And I think that a lot of people do that. I know that the women that I work with now is like, we spend an awful lot of time trying to pinpoint where it went wrong.
Right.
And there may not be a place where it went wrong. Sometimes it's just an idea that you get in your head that you're just not good enough and you believe it. And then you start acting out of that place. You know, and that's what happened to me.
And what happened when you get to Florida? What does it look like? How does it show up for you, this anxiety that's kind of screaming to get out?
Yeah, there was, you know, I was just the acting out was very like I had no communication. I didn't really know how to express myself. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know what my needs were, anything like that. And also, of course, I had lost my friend circle as such.
Yeah.
I was out of context. And I wasn't fitting in very well. I wasn't translating to American very well. Mm-hmm. So I was, I very much went towards the Irish community. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a great time in Florida, but I partied hard.
Right.
And it was very, and I was underage too.
Yes,
so
of
that,
course.
Yeah, yeah. So that I wasn't impressed by that either, you know. So I just was very like, just unhappy about the whole thing. And then I came home. I just packed my bags and came back to Ireland.
How soon?
Within maybe 18 months.
Really? So you're not even 20?
I was about 20 when I came home.
Come back on your own?
Yeah.
Really? How did that go down at home?
We still had the house in Sagard at that time. Mm-hmm. So I moved in there. I don't know.
Big house on your own.
Yeah, big house on my own. And then my dad would be coming and going as well because he'd have been gigging at home.
He was working, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So he was in and out. And was your relationship, was it strained?
With my parents?
Yeah, when you had left, obviously, Florida, left the whole
family. Oh, God, no. God, no. No, no, not at all. I just decided I wanted to go back home. You know, I was homesick. I was always homesick. Sure, I remember getting homesick in Mexico on a two-week holiday, you know, because I was listening to U2.
Right, and you
drunk in the swimming pool at 2 a.m. I was like, no, I want to go home.
Did you know what you were missing?
At home.
As in, yeah, what was the homesickness? What was missing that you needed to go back to Dublin, which you did?
Yeah, I know now, let's say, from where I stand now, that something that's incredibly important to me is connection. Feeling, you know, and a sense of belonging. And that's really what it was about, you know. And it wasn't just geographic, you know. It was like just feeling secure and settled somewhere, you know.
So you did. You came back. Did you have a plan?
No, I've never had a plan in my life. What's that?
Things go out of control, I suppose, do they? Basically?
Yeah. Well, of course. You know, one of the things that was, you know, my only outlet was having the crack, having fun, and then of course. The whole idea of connection and belonging, like I didn't really have much of a repertoire when it came to how to spend my time, you know.
Right.
So it was really just partying is what I did. And that's how I spent my time.
You can find a tribe for that, no doubt.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, you were a very generous partier as well, I think you...
A generous partier?
Yeah, as in you like to give things away and you like to...
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I was very much a party animal and, you know, someone who was good cracked it. Like, you'd never know what had happened when I'd be around kind of a thing, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And it wasn't just me. It was, you know, my friends. We were all a bit mad, you know? We were all musicians and we were all into the...
And there was a bit of boom as well in the 90s in Ireland. There was a bit of confidence growing, so...
Yeah.
You wouldn't have looked out of place, would you, enjoying yourself?
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. It was we were all at it. I had no idea that it was like this was normal. And in fact, anybody who wasn't partying the way I was partying, I thought they were, you know, just a drip or something.
Right, that they were the dry shite.
At one point, I actually, like, I used to proudly declare that I didn't trust people who didn't drink. You know?
You cut your hair off at one stage of the party.
Yeah, I did. And at the time... you know, looking back in hindsight, it's quite disturbing how something like that would happen. Yeah, I was at a party and there was a guy there that I was, you know, I was into, and I thought we had a thing. And it turned out that he obviously did not share the same, and he took an interest in a friend of mine, and off they went together. And I just was absolutely gutted, you know, but again, did not know how to deal with that. All of the insecurities that it triggered, I basically had a panic attack. And instead of sitting in that discomfort, I took a scissors out of the kitchen press and I just started lobbing my hair off in the middle of this shenanigans as a kind of like, again, it was that bravado. It was like, I don't care. Like, look how much I don't care. And it was just like, at the time, it, you know, everyone was egging me on and I thought I was great. And it was one of those, it was a distraction, you know, it was just another distraction from my true feelings. And when I woke up the next morning and, you know, the way it slowly dawns on you, what, you know, what did I do? What did I, and then reaching up to my hair, this hair on the pillow, and I'm going, what the? And then looking at myself in the mirror, and I was just like, I just felt so violated. And I had done it to myself. And my friend at the time was a hairdresser, and I went to her and I was like, God, like, help. And we had to shave my head all over. And she said I took chunks out of my scalp, you know. And it was just like, I had to wear a bandana till it kind of grew back out a little bit again.
What did your family make of this?
Well, they would have been in America as well. So, like, there was a lot that they weren't seeing. And I was also very good at hiding anyway.
Really?
You know, yeah, because I would have probably, some of me moving around so much would have been that running away, you know, running away so that I could be this person out of sight, you know, like, because the people I love were horrified.
Did you know that this was a problem at the time?
No, no, it wasn't obvious to me at all.
Because people thought you're the gas character who will do these funny things.
Yeah, I thought the problem was me, you know, I thought the problem was just that I was, you know, doing life wrong, failing, you know, and that I was inadequate. I just wasn't enough. But that was a very private kind of a fear and a shame, you know.
Did you have a job at this stage? Did you have a career? What were you doing?
I had several jobs. I worked in hospitality a lot and hotels over the years. At one point then I started flirting with the idea of songwriting. I was songwriting and... I didn't love the performance aspect of it, but it was the creative process that I enjoyed, and actually it was the self-expression. It was an outlet for me. So that creative thing was always, that was the place where I was confiding, you know. So even though I had all of this like destructive coping going on the outside, mm-hmm. but I had a companion. My creativity was kind of there with me all along, and it's the thing that ended up really helping me recover.
I presume because you have successful parents that puts a pressure on you. And if you have an artistic bent in you, basically, you're kind of thinking, can I match that success? Is that the pressure that you think you were under?
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people do that. You know, we follow a kind of an invisible script or a blueprint, or, you know, there are just like... trajectories that we think we must follow in order to be a successful adult, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not unique to me, but whatever it is that you think you should be, if it's not for you, you're going to have that kind of conflict, you know. So yeah, I absolutely put a lot of pressure on myself to be at certain, because my father was, you know, successful at 21.
Yeah,
you know, like I think his first number one was when he was 21 or something like that. So that was there too, you know, this kind of like success out the gate kind of a thing, you know.
And decades of it.
Yeah.
So you got lost in the drinking. Did it become really bad? Could you still function? Could you still work?
I was functioning. Yeah, I say that now. I don't think I was. Now, looking back, I was not really. Maybe I was barely functioning. But also, like I said, I had gotten very good, as, you know, us addicts do, at hiding the consequences of our behaviours. So, yeah, it got to a point eventually, you know, I turned 40 and then I had a couple of life events that really, you know, crashed down on top of me and really brought all of that coping to a head. And I quit drinking because it no longer felt safe. You know,
how did that come about? How did you know that this was the time?
I I had been introduced through an artist friend. So I was doing a workshop in my studio at the time in Sligo, and I had an artist travel over from California to attend this workshop. And while she was there, she said, I'm going to connect you with a friend of mine.
Okay.
She's also an artist, she said, only she doesn't drink. And I was like, yeah, I don't know why do you think that we'd be friends? You know, because I'm still in my, oh, please, a non-drinker, no thanks. So she introduced us in about December or January. And then that December or January, I kind of went into that new year with a restlessness. And I was like, I was going to do this thing. I had been dealing with an eating disorder for a long time, but I hadn't acknowledged it. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of secretly made a pact with myself that I was going to fix this thing. And so I went into the new year with that in mind. And of course, not knowing how to do that, a lot of the solutions I chose were the wrong ones. But anyway.
And again, that's the dieting thing, because it's the new year's. And you've a very good theory on dieting, don't you? As in its association with gambling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is very much like gambling, because diets work just like horses win races, mm-hmm. you know. And so, you know, that's why we keep going back to them. They win. But we have this bias where we don't see what it's costing us. We don't see where we're losing, you know, that it's ultimately the house always wins, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same deal.
That's I love that insight.
Mm.
That you can get hooked on dieting because you get the odd win, but by and large, it's not working for you.
No, no, the house will always win, because you're not changing what's at the very root of the behaviour. You know, why are you turning to food in the first place? You know, why is that a solution to your life?
You were having an extraordinary bad run because you also suffered two miscarriages as
yeah,
well along
around the same time. Yeah, so I turned 40. And then I just took it upon myself that I was going to learn how to do this food thing. And then two pregnancies came back to back, lost both of those. And again, just the coping, all of that, like, did not know how to cope with any of this.
Mm.
And that's when the change started. I put the bottle down and I started walking this path, this road of recovery, which was, almost 10 years ago now.
Wow. It's different for everybody. Some people go into actual rehab.
Mm-hmm.
They follow the 12-step program. Did you have a different route or how did you manage to do it?
Yeah, so the lady who I had been introduced to, she had started a podcast, and she was sober about 2 years, and she's an artist and she's a creative. So I was listening to her as all of this was going on in my world, you know. And she started to paint a picture of sobriety that allowed me to access it, because we all have this idea that you have to be a falling down, non-functional drunk to avail of recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know?
That's the Irish bad attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a grey area. And as destructive as my behaviour was, I was still in the grey area, because I was still a functioning person who did not look like she had a problem. You know, it was all on the inside. The chaos was all on the inside. And it was just, well, I say it was just affecting me, but of course it wasn't. It was affecting all of my relationships, my finances, everything was affected. But I had normalized that. So listening to her kind of gave me another option. And so that's what I did there. But I was, and because I gave up drinking for safety reasons, I didn't have to white knuckle it. But the patterns were still there underneath, and life still had to be lived. And I was still a gambler, you know, in the way that I think about things and play with solutions. And, you know, it was only in the last year and a half that I stepped into the 12 steps and,
oh, really?
And started actually working a spiritual program and getting emotionally sober.
Emotionally sober as opposed to the real thing. What's that difference?
So there's a difference between being abstinent and being sober. Being abstinent, like, is just not engaging with the substance, you know. Mm. But being emotional sober is dealing with the patterns that are deep down underneath, you know, like, and questioning those beliefs, changing your attitude, understanding your needs, your values, and actually tending to them, you know, actually looking after yourself, like practicing actual self-care. You know,
it's been an extraordinary couple of years. 10 years sober. Congratulations.
Yes.
How do you?
Oh, 8 years. Sorry.
Sorry, 8 years. Well, yeah. Congratulations on the 8 years. How do you cope with the, because obviously motherhood didn't happen for you.
Yeah.
That must have been another thing that you have to.
It was a big dilemma, yeah. And it was something I agonised over for years. I was so on the fence about it, but I know now. And what I learned from that is, what I did learn is the importance of clarity, the importance of knowing yourself, the importance of looking at your motivations. I think that I was reaching for motherhood because I thought I should. You know, right. I think a lot of women think that, you know, it's something that we should want, and you're a bad person if you don't want it.
Right.
And the truth, as it turned out, was that I didn't want it. It wasn't for me. Maybe I would have wanted it if I hadn't got such a, like a difficult relationship with myself. I was at war with my body. Mm-hmm. There's no way I would have emotionally coped with the physical aspect even of pregnancy, given the state of my relationship with myself. So it wasn't the path for me, and I made peace with that. I got clarity around that, and I made a decision, and that was really, really empowering. You know, of course you do grieve. You grieve things that you even voluntarily let go of, you know. But I embraced the possibilities that opened up for me by making that decision. It was like, up till that point, it was like driving with the handbrake on.
Really?
Yeah.
It's kind of constantly in your head.
Yeah, and you're kind of like this hesitancy to go for anything else because you might, you know.
What possibilities open up to you?
Well, I knew that, like, from a vocational point of view, so the clarity that I got is that, like, the only thing that was really attracting me to motherhood was this idea of nurturing and kind of like working with, like, just being involved in the developmental growth of another human being, you know, having the kind of parenting aspect of it. Mm. And I realized that I could meet that need through my work as a mentor, as a coach, as a guide, you know. And then, of course, being an artist, you know, I can make babies every single day, you know, like in my studio. So you just, every time I make a piece of art, it's something birthed into the world.
Are relationships, marriages, are they stronger when you're relying on each other, when there aren't children on the scene, yourself and Terry?
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know any different,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But I imagine.
You hear it sometimes, you know. That.
Well, I imagine that there would be stressors, you know, and an awful lot more cooperation involved, you know. So we're very independent of each other, you know, in terms of, like, there's not an awful lot that we have to agree on, and therefore there's not an awful lot we have to fight over. Do you know? So, and then the financial stressors and all the decisions. There's an awful lot of labour.
What do you do in your business? Because this is what you focus your time on now. And you look like you could be in showbiz.
You
really do have a great look about you.
Thank you.
You look cool, you know.
Well, thank you very much. As somebody who always struggles with image, it's great to be able to receive a compliment like that. And, you know, so what do I do now? Well, I write and I podcast and everything I do and put out into the world. I work with women as well, is about helping people unlearn these scripts and these beliefs and build the inner resilience to live a life on their own terms and to discover in the process what feels like happiness, you know, what would really make them happy.
And if people, you have a Substack as well. So you're writing there. Mm-hmm. You've got a podcast with Mel Grace.
I have two podcasts. One with my sister Mel. That one is called The Road Back Home. Yes.
And that's going on the road, by the looks of it. It's on the Nina Arts Centre on the 3rd of April.
The Nina Arts Centre on the 3rd of April is a Thursday night. And we are launching our podcast, and it's going to be a live show. It's going to be great crack.
Well, the time has completely run away on me here. So thank you so much for coming and sharing the story.
Thank you so much.
AmandaGrace.ie. Sorry, have I got the resume?
Yes,
AmandaGrace.ie.
That's right.
You'll find your Substack and your podcasts,
yes,
and all the
indeed.
Details that's going on. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to hear that you're well.
Yes.
If I pass in the street, I think there's a Berlin artist now who knows things about the world.
There you are. Now there's a woman at peace with herself.
We have to go to a break. Thanks so much. AmandaGrace there.